eventually became Longley's deputy for counterattacks, and henceforth shared his command post. A briefing took place every morning at 0900, which was attended by the five Cartier commanders, plus Longley, Bijard, Colonel Vaillant, the artillery commander, the officer in charge of supply operations, usually Major de Brinon, Guérin from the Air Force, and an officer representing Colonel de Castries. The progressive alienation, if not estrangement, of de Castries from the battle was part of a process which to this day is not clearly understood even by the men who witnessed it. To be sure, every day Bijard made it a point of reporting personally to de Castries on the decisions made by the command group during the morning briefing. Apparently, his even temper sat better with de Castries than that of the more ebullient Longley. Usually, these reports left little for further decision-making by the nominal commander of the fortress, except perhaps to couch the often brutally direct messages forwarded by the paratroop commanders into terms more amenable to the refined ears of the rear echelon command in Hanoi. On April 11, 1954, there were, in addition to Longley, six lieutenant colonels in the Dien Bien Phu perimeter, and perhaps 20 majors. Yet the fate of Dien Bien Phu, and indeed of the whole Indochina War, rested in the hands of Longley and his little band of brothers. Later, Bijard was to say that the morning briefings not only served to recapitulate the situation in the camp, to plan counterattacks and establish supply schedules, but also, and perhaps above all, to serve as a precious boost to morale. He put it in simple terms. Our comradeship was excellent, and after all, we were fighting for our skins. The enemy had also reappraised the situation. It was clear to Giap that to conquer Dien Bien Phu by frontal attacks at the price of destroying a large part of his regulars would play into the hands of the French High Command. To many of Giap's subordinates, the situation at Dien Bien Phu, after the initial easy but costly victories over the French, now dangerously resembled some of the other battles which the PAVN had fought against the French in prepared positions and which had cost it extremely heavy losses. There is no question but that the week of April 11th to 18th was one during which combat morale on the Communist side was lowest and that on the French side highest. In fact, French radio intelligence in the fortress picked up agitated messages from lower unit commanders reporting that certain units refused to obey orders. Prisoners openly admitted that in some instances they had been made to advance by actual threats of being shot from behind by their own guns. Hence, Giap decided to revert to tried-and-true trench warfare tactics of the Ypres salient of World War I. With tens of thousands of coolies available from the road-building jobs on the supply lines, every French position was soon surrounded by a spiderweb of approach trenches, many of them carefully burrowed underground for long stretches until they emerged inside the French barbed wire or even at the French bunker line. In some cases, mine galleries would be dug, particularly in the Five Hills area, where Regiment 98 of the 316th People's Army Division held the line. The 98th had been recruited largely from among the Vietnamese of the Dong Tru area, which is one of the major coal mining areas of North Vietnam. Many of the men from the 98th were former coal miners and were familiar with the digging of shafts and the preparation of explosive charges. One day, the surprised Longley was informed from Hanoi that he would receive a shipment of geophones. Indeed, a few days later, there was parachuted a load of flat French Army wine canteens with medical stethoscopes, along with a short notice on how to listen for the noise of underground digging. Hanoi was also full of good advice on how to build countermines, that is, assuming that one had an unlimited amount of construction wood, manpower, and dynamite. In the case of Dien Bien Phu, precious airborne cargo space had to be used at times to parachute in the minimum amount of construction materials necessary merely to keep in existence some of the strong points, which were rapidly crumbling away under the combined effects of the monsoon rains and enemy artillery. But when the nights were calm, the defenders of Allianz 1 and 2 could hear the clinking of picks and shovels almost under their feet. And they could hear it without using the geophones. That day also, the Viet Minh began to tighten its hold around Huguet 1, which until now had been to the rear of the battle line. In fact, the counterattack on Five Hills and the bloody struggle for E1 had completely obscured the total deterioration on Huguet. There, what was left of Clemenceau's 1-2 Foreign Legion was being bled white at a fast clip. On April 8, the last remnants of 1st and 3rd Companies were merged into a Compagnie de Marche, provisional company, under Lieutenant François, and the NCO training unit was dissolved and formed into Compagnie de Marche 313, in memory of the battalion which had been slaughtered on the first day of the battle on Beatrice. That company was commanded by Captain Philippe. On April 9, a new reorganization took place as the battle for E1 drained off the last reserves. François' company relieved Clédic's company of the 2-1 RCP on Huguette 6, and Huguette 4 was yielded to a mixed Moroccan company and became part of the new strongpoint Lily under the name of Lily 3. Finally, the already wounded Captain Bizard relieved Minot and his 4th company, 2-1 RCP, from H6, so that they could participate in the assault on E1. Bizard took command of H6, and Philippe and his deputy, Lieutenant Legros, installed themselves with the newly formed 313 Company on Huguette 2. This left Lieutenant Sposio, who already had been wounded during the fight for H7 on April 2nd, with his badly weakened 2nd Company, 1-2 REI, to hold Huguette 1. And on that Sunday, Sposio's men made an attempt once more to clear the tentacular communist trenches which were in the process of encircling them. They were virtually submerged by 3 Viet Minh companies that seemingly emerged from nowhere. Within a few minutes, one platoon from H2 and another from 4th Company were committed to save Sposio's outfit from being swallowed up. The 105s from Claudine chimed in, and a few minutes later again the 2 tanks available for combat at the moment entered the fray under the command of 2nd Lieutenant Mengele. But the new strangulation tactics of the communists seemed to work perfectly. One of the French tanks sustained a bazooka hit, and both Sposio and Legros were badly wounded. While Sposio could still be dragged back by his men, Legros had to be abandoned to the communists, in whose hands he died a few hours later. But that was not the worst of it. 2nd Company had not succeeded in shaking off the encirclement, and for the first time, the communists held on to approach trenches in broad daylight. This augured ill for the future. Monday, April 12, 1954. As night fell on Sunday, communist artillery again opened up on Elion 1, followed within a few minutes by battalions 215 and 439 of the 98th People's Army Regiment. This time, General Vu Mang Hong was determined to conquer and hold E1 for good. In view of the lack of any kind of obstacles in front of the first trenches on E1, the whole fight degenerated almost immediately into hand-to-hand combat. With communist infiltrators seeping in between E1 and E4, Brezhnev ordered Trapp's and Lepage's companies from the 6th BPC into the fight. And on it went, man against man all night long in the trenches and bunkers of Elion 1. By 0700, Regiment 98 had had enough. What was left of the 2 first wave battalions, numbers 215 and 439, engaged in the assault, began to roll back down the eastern slope of E1, pursued again by the mortars and the artillery of Dien Bien Phu. According to the Viet Minh manual on the assault of fortified positions, a 3-to-1 superiority of the assailant over the defender was required. In that night attack, the Viet Minh had a 7-to-1 superiority, but the thin line of paratroops held. Again, their losses had been heavy. The 2 small companies of the RCP alone had lost 19 killed and 66 wounded, including 2 officers, while the BEP had had 47 casualties. That meant that the 154 reinforcements for the 2nd BEP, who had been parachuted into Dien Bien Phu that night, merely made up for the night's losses, but did not represent an increase of strength. The 3rd and 4th companies of the 2-1 RCP were now so depleted that Brezhnev dissolved them and formed them into a Compagnie de Marche under the command of 2nd Lieutenant Leguerre. That left 1st Company, 2-1 RCP, under Lieutenant Pierrot, as the last ready reserve. Just before noon, Brezhnev committed it to the defense of Elion 1. With Perrieux on E1 and Clédic now in reserve on E4, the 2-1 immediately solved one of its major problems, that of secure voice radio communications. With the communists being plentifully equipped with captured American radio sets of exactly the same type as those which the French had, secure radio communications, except for the top-secret Z-13 ultra-high-frequency radio telephone link between De Castries and Hanoi and the messages sent in code, were non-existent, and often the Viet Minh would successfully jam French communications or simply horn in on them. In any case, they would be constantly listened to. This was particularly bothersome when the communications involved exact relief hours for unit changes. In some cases, such as in communications between De Castries and Lieutenant Colonel Lalande on Isabel, English was used, since both officers spoke it fluently, and, at least in 1954, the chances of the Viet Minh having trilingual radio operators were almost nil. The same system was used in communications between Clemenceau and Bizard, since the latter had been educated in London. The North African units often would converse in Arabic as a way of throwing off indiscreet listeners, but in the case of Clédic and Perriot, conversations were totally foolproof. Both were Bretons. Their language, which resembles Welsh, was incomprehensible not only to the Viet Minh, but also to other Frenchmen, except other Bretons. These conversations in a totally strange language were of course also picked up by French radio intelligence and resulted in at least one urgent message informing Hanoi that radio traffic in an unknown Asian language had been picked up near Dien Bien Phu. If the news was not too discouraging on the ground, air support remained the main worry of the garrison that day. At 11:30, a French Navy privateer four-engine bomber of Squadron 28, which was plastering enemy positions with the newly arrived American Lazy Dog bombs, was hit by enemy anti-aircraft fire northwest of Almerie and disintegrated. Its chief pilot, Ensign Mankanowski, died with the aircraft to give the other two men, Petty Officers Carpentier and Caronis, a chance to jump. They parachuted safely and were taken prisoner. A few minutes later, at 1200, a B-26 dive-bombed Sparrowhawk by mistake, which, aside from the damage it caused to the strongpoint, gave Lieutenant Colonel Longley a severe jolt. For one fleeting moment of panic, he thought that the Red Chinese Air Force had intervened in the battle. This, as far as Dien Bien Phu was concerned, would have meant death on short notice. As Longley tells the story, he left the commander of Sparrowhawk, Major Touré, somewhat perplexed when, on being apprised by him over the telephone that his strongpoint had been bombed by a French airplane, Longley exclaimed, "Thank God it's one of ours!" But that was only the beginning of a particularly jinxed air support operation. Things were to get far worse on the following day. Tuesday, April 13, 1954. While the ground war slackened for a time, Dien Bien Phu was again beset with airlift problems. Too much of the precious deliveries simply were misdropped to the other side. The effect was felt not only in the supply gaps of the garrison, but also in such unnerving situations as the intensive shelling during the night of April 12th to 13th of much of the Dien Bien Phu area by brutally effective 105mm shells equipped with new American short-delay fuses that came directly from misdropped supplies. Many of the French dugout and underground positions, which had thus far successfully resisted enemy artillery fire, were now pierced by the shells and destroyed. French-American cooperation in the supply operations also left something to be desired. 24 of the 29 C-119s flying as part of the French supply operations had American crews under contract to the Taiwan-based Civil Air Transport Corporation, CAT. Officially, the crews were all civilian, but in actual fact, some American military pilots had been quietly detached to CAT to familiarize themselves with the area in case of American air intervention on behalf of the French. Since the crews spoke no French and most of the French air control personnel spoke no English, communications were often difficult, particularly so in the forward combat area. Dien Bien Phu, with its limited radio facilities, often had to deal simultaneously with 30 or 40 aircraft operating near and over the valley. Rather than engage in lengthy and sometimes fruitless conversations with the ground, the U.S. crews often tended to follow their own experience or their own flight leaders. That also had happened during the night of April 12th to 13th, and at 09:30 of April 13th, De Castries bitterly complained that the American crews refused to take into account at all the indications given by our own air liaison headquarters down here. When later in the day, the French Air Force added injury to insult by bombing some of the French-held strongpoints three times, then Dien Bien Phu also found out what exactly had been the content of the cargo lost by the C-119s during the previous night, De Castries in person sent another radio message to Hanoi, informing it of the bombing and of the fact that the five full plane loads of ammunition represented at least 800 rounds of artillery ammunition. No comment. Signed, De Castries. And the day was to continue like this. At 14:25, a fighter bomber dropped its bombs between strongpoints H1 and H6, while another dropped its bombs on a French ammunition depot inside Dien Bien Phu, which blew up, killed several soldiers in the area, and destroyed close to 1,000 rounds of precious 105mm howitzer ammunition. And while this went on, another C-119 again managed to drop its whole cargo of 105mm ammunition on the northeastern slope of communist-held Dominique 1. And again, as in earlier weeks, there was the gnawing need for specialists. The GAP-2, for example, had a signal organization originally designed to operate with 3 independent battalions. Now, the GAP was in control of 6 airborne battalions, but had, if anything, lost signal personnel rather than added to it. What was left of the 2 Foreign Legion outfits in the main center of the fortress was hardly large enough for one single battalion, let alone a half brigade, and de Castries insisted that Foreign Legion replacements be dropped in. At the news, a complete Foreign Legion battalion in the Red River Delta volunteered, including its commanding officer. Yet the replacements who had come in during the previous night amounted to only 71 men, including another airborne surgical team, ACP No. 5, under Captain Hans, which was installed in the area of the half-brigade's headquarters, hardly enough to make up for the day's losses. Finally, at 19:15, for no apparent reason, the communist artillery again opened up with a violent bombardment of the headquarters area and the artillery positions on Claudine. The gun pits of the 4th Battery, 2-4 RAC, seemed to be singled out for particular punishment. The enemy volley finally hit its mark, destroying completely one howitzer and setting afire the ammunition depot. The battery commander, gallant Lieutenant Brunbroek, who had saved Dominique 3 2 weeks earlier, lay dying in his half-collapsed command post, his back torn open by shell fragments but still conscious. "Keep firing," said Brunbroek to one of the crew chiefs standing next to him. "We've got to show them." Still conscious when Father Tricon crawled over from headquarters to give him absolution, he died calmly a few minutes later. Wednesday, April 14th, 1954. As the fog cleared on April 14th, the first French patrols on their way to strongpoints Huguette 1 and 6 suddenly encountered an obstacle whose creation during the past night had been drowned in the noise of the artillery bombardment. A communist commando force had infiltrated the airfield and had blasted a trench almost completely across the southernmost third of the airfield, about halfway between H1 and H2. Almost simultaneously, at 10:20, H1 reported that it was almost completely surrounded on its western perimeter by occupied Viet Minh trenches, as close as 15 meters from its outer barbed wire. The latter also had been blasted during the night by Bangalore torpedoes, and a 3-meter gap had been blasted into it, which reached all the way to the innermost strands. At 1200, elements from the 6th and 8th BPC attempted to break through to H1, but found themselves blocked north and west of H5, east of H2, and north of Sparrowhawk by new minefields placed across the airfield area and by extremely dense communist mortar fire. This meant, in effect, that both H1 and H6 were now almost completely sealed off from the rest of Dien Bien Phu. If both fell, Dien Bien Phu would lose about 20% of its area, including 2/3 of its airfield. Not that the latter was important per se, but its loss would mean that the communists could install anti-aircraft machine guns in closer to the main center of Dien Bien Phu, and the parachute aircraft would have to run a flak gauntlet even tighter than before. And thus began the second battle for the Huguettes. Indeed, as the battle in the northwest of the fortress was beginning to take shape, there were other signs that the enemy, far from relinquishing his hold on Dien Bien Phu if he failed to take it by April 15th, was in fact reinforcing his position. Messages intercepted and decoded by the French indicated that battalions 910 and 920 of the famous Mountaineer Regiment 148 were being recalled from Laos, along with Battalion 970 of Regiment 176 of the 316th Division, all three of which had been operating in Laos as advisers to the indigenous Papet Lao rebels. Giap also ordered that Battalion 900 of Regiment 148, which was a mixed elite outfit providing support for the regimental headquarters of the 148, detach for duty at Dien Bien Phu such additional units as the 523rd Signal Company and the 121st Heavy Company, with its 6 recoilless cannon and its 4 mortars. In addition, Regiment 9 of the 304th Division received orders to join its sister regiment, 57304, in the siege ring at Dien Bien Phu, and finally, Red China was asked to provide immediately an additional 720 tons of ammunition and one more complete flak regiment with 67 37mm anti-aircraft guns. What with the thousands of individual reserves called up from rearward training camps, the Viet Minh siege force had been able to more than make up its earlier losses, even if some of the new replacements were inexperienced and often extremely young. As the final struggle for the airstrip now began, General Giap still could field at least 35,000 frontline troops and 12,000 artillerymen and engineers. The French, even after the successful airdrops of the first half of April, still had less than 5,000 fighting men at their disposal. Indeed, the arrival of two airborne battalions and other individually parachuted replacements was slim consolation in the face of the statistics compiled by Major Groin for the field hospitals inside Dien Bien Phu. From April 1st to April 15th, 751 wounded had been admitted, of whom 310 required surgical operations, and 76 had died. Those figures, of course, did not include the hundreds of men relatively lightly wounded again and again, or those who died at their positions. As for the conditions under which the wounded had to live, they merely deteriorated from the atrocious to the intolerable as the monsoon rains began to seep into the underground dugouts in mid-April. The consequences of this new catastrophe for the wounded soon became evident. On April 17th, the hospitals reported their first cases of gangrene. But the major problem for Groin was lack of space. Like an octopus, the hospital had continued to grow in all directions. Every night, the available Moroccan sappers of the 31st Engineering Battalion were at work digging new tunnels into the ground in order to make room for the wounded. Finally, there simply was nowhere else to go but into the dugouts of other units. Here, the requirements of the hospital also inflamed a long-standing vendetta between Longley and French Central Intelligence. Ever since the beginning of the battle, Longley had felt that Central Intelligence's local unit, Commando Group GC-8, had become totally useless and that its operatives should be included among the infantry of the fortress, just as the aviators were. Since the detachment commander, Captain Hébert, was in fact not under the command of anyone inside Dien Bien Phu, but, as is the case with other intelligence agencies, responsible only to his own superiors in Hanoi and Saigon, Longley was in no position to make the order stick. He thereupon issued an official note to all paratroop units on March 22nd, informing them that Hébert and his unit had preferred to remain burrowed in comfortable dugouts rather than join the fight. Longley went even one step further when, on March 28th, as senior paratroop officer in the valley, he ordered Captain Hébert, who was also a paratrooper, to stop wearing the hallowed red beret of the colonial paratroops. Longley, whose impulsiveness was well known, was being somewhat unjust to GC-8. Hébert, far from being a chair-born intelligence officer, had earned his paratrooper wings during dangerous behind-the-lines missions in World War II, in the course of which he had been severely wounded. As a result, one of his legs was 7 centimeters shorter than the other. Nevertheless, in October 1953, he had volunteered to be parachuted into enemy territory in Indochina with one of the GCMA outfits and had been made a Knight of the Legion of Honor for his achievements. Now, Longley seized an opportunity for liquidating once and for all what he called that state within a state of the Central Intelligence Station. Faced with the urgent requirements of Groin's hospital for more space, Longley walked into the dugouts of GC-8 on April 9th, escorted by a few of his armed paratroopers, and simply ordered the Mayo tribespeople to vacate them. They at first tried to pass through the enemy siege ring, even at the risk of being captured and tortured by the Viet Minh. Two of them were killed during the night of the 10th and another during the night of the 11th, while many others, including women and children, were wounded by the fire of both sides. In a radio message to his own superiors in Hanoi, Hébert argued that "everybody here is afraid of Longley," and requested support. A mild rebuke to Longley by de Castri only increased the fury of the former against Central Intelligence, and, on April 14th, Longley actually sent a squad of tough foreign legionnaires into the GC-8 area with direct orders to clear the premises, if need be, with hand grenades. It finally took a direct order from General Cogny and a threat of grave personal sanctions for Longley to leave the last remnants of GC-8 alone. but he did succeed in providing Groan's hospital with enough bunker space for over 200 wounded, even though the area was separated from the hospital by the much-traveled segment of Road 41 that passed right through the camp. The indefatigable 31st Engineers solved this problem one night by digging a complete trench through the road and covering it with wooden beams and steel plates from the airfield. This left Groan with just one more problem. The constant extension of the graveyard near the hospital. One of the remaining bulldozers did little else during the relatively safe night hours but dig vast trenches for the next day's cargo of dead, had brought about a pullulation of huge slimy white maggots which now infiltrated the tomb-like galleries where the wounded were lying and which soon could be found crawling about the open festering wounds. There was simply no way of holding them back or of exterminating them. In the long list of pressing airdrop priorities, medical supplies often had to accept a secondary position to ammunition and gasoline. It was simply impossible to find space for the hundreds of pounds of disinfectants that were required when fresh blood, plasma, and even simple items such as wound alcohol came in carefully measured quantities. Groan explained to the wounded that the maggots fed only on dead or putrescent bone and flesh, and, for all their unwholesome aspect, contributed to keeping wounds clean. It is not known whether his explanation made anyone feel any better, but at least it calmed the panic of those wounded who believed that the appearance of the maggots in their bandages was a sure sign of coming death. Yet another problem which had become acute on April 14th was that of food. Supplying an isolated force of 16,000 men for 56 days under combat conditions was a feat which, over a similar length of time, had been equaled only at Stalingrad. To realize how complicated the food supply problem for Dien Bien Phu was, it must be realized that there were 6 different types of food rations allocated: European, North African, African, Vietnamese, Thai Auxiliary, and PIM, the PWs. For example, it was impossible to feed the standard pork meat of American or French canned rations to the pork-shunning Muslims. The Europeans could not subsist indefinitely on rice, but all Vietnamese considered rice a staple. As it became less and less possible to cook, the men began to rely more and more on canned combat rations. There was therefore a strong possibility that much of the garrison would fall victim to diseases connected with the lack of vitamins, such as scurvy or beriberi. Hence, a concerted effort was made to have all the men eat raw onion and fruits, even during the worst of the battle. A brief list of the major consumable supply items shows what this meant in actual practice. It also showed some of the peculiarly French aspects of the problem. Rice, 791 tons. Frozen meat, 195 tons. Dried bread, 473 tons. Fresh vegetables, 25 tons. Individual combat rations, 623,194. Survival rations, 22,760. Wine, 49,720 gallons. Wine concentrate, 7.062 gallons. Mustard, 60 kilograms. Among the other items parachuted, one may note a total of 2,952 tubes of toothpaste and only 16,460 razor blades, even if one admits that the smooth-skinned Vietnamese among the garrison hardly ever needed a shave. This still meant that over the 3 months of battle, hardly more than 2 or 3 razor blades were consumed by each man. The tightening of the siege ring around the drop zones compelled both Hanoi and the command at Dien Bien Phu to make an agonizing daily choice between the airplane space accorded for reinforcements, munitions, and medical supplies, and that allotted to food. The result, obviously, was that food took the lowest priority, and that units were, at critical moments, compelled to live off survival rations ordinarily to be consumed only in dire emergencies. Thus it happened that on April 7th, Dien Bien Phu ran out of food rations except for those already distributed to the individual units. While the battle raged for E1 and the northern part of Ouguet was in the process of being sealed off, the combat units were authorized on April 11th to consume 1 day's worth of the 3 they had theoretically in stock of survival rations. The following days brought some relief, as the airdrops on April 13th to 14th climbed to the never-again-to-be-reached height of 217 and 229 tons. But on the evening of April 14th, events were to smash all hope of building up adequate reserves. As the surviving trucks and jeeps collected the food in the headquarters area to ensure its proper distribution, a rain of communist artillery shells set fire to the unprotected mound of easily combustible food. More than 300 kilograms of cheese, 700 kilograms of tea, 700 kilograms of coffee, 450 kilograms of salt, 110 kilograms of chocolate, and 5,080 individual rations were lost. This disaster matched another a few days earlier, in which the whole camp's tobacco reserve was set afire, an incident which caused Long Lei to say that all of Dien Bien Phu smelled as if it were smoking a gigantic pipe. From April 14th onward, Dien Bien Phu remained on short rations, and on April 29th, it actually went on half rations. Not only was the garrison being bled white by the enemy and short of ammunition, it was fighting most of the time on empty stomachs as well. On April 14th also, the struggle between Long Lei and the paratroop bureaucrats reached its highest level on both sides. In a telegram which had obviously been prepared by Long Lei for De Castries' signature, the latter told Cogny in no uncertain terms what the exact situation inside the fortress was, and began his message with what turned out to be an incredibly accurate prophecy. 1. Reference your telegram 1931, dealing with the dropping of non-parachutists. The fate of GONO will be sealed by May 10th, regardless of parachute training regulations. Inform you that effectives 113 Half Brigade, 12 REI, 313 Half Brigade, holding West Flank, are respectively 354, 380, 80. 14 RTM, with two combat-worthy companies, holds Southwest. Airborne Battalion's total effectives approach 2,500, hold the other flanks, and constitute the reserves. Stop. 2. Evolution of enemy works threatens Huguette 1 and Huguette 6. Attempt at clearing Huguette 1 this morning fell upon numerous mined zones between Huguette 1, Huguette 3, and Huguette 5, and mortar and artillery fire. Will be attempted again at nightfall, at the same time as repairs on landing strip. Stop. 3. At 0800, transmitter of Regiment 102, 308, announced to its subordinate units to stand by for important news. Stop. 4. Insist once more upon dropping each night 5 aircraft of personnel. Stop. End. Signed, De Castries. Otherwise, little else happened at Dien Bien Phu that day. One electric generator urgently needed to provide the fortress with electric power for its transmitters, water purifiers, and minimal illumination was parachuted but so poorly packed that it shattered on landing. And somebody in Hanoi had not yet heard about the pressure effects of a brutal airdrop on a completely filled gasoline jerry can. Instead of allowing space for the gasoline to slosh around in, the dropped jerry cans were filled to the rim and promptly burst upon landing. De Brinon, a Foreign Legion major who had been pulled out from the 113th to serve as airdrop controller at De Castries' headquarters, sent a brief message on the subject to Hanoi. Tell the air supply companies to do their job right. Now we don't have enough gasoline to keep our tanks going. Indeed, there were things wrong with the French air supply system. Prior to the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, nobody apparently had dreamed that so large a garrison would have to be fed by airdrops. Only a steady stream of American parachutes from Japan kept the air supply effort from collapsing. Until late in the battle, only the Airborne Supply Center in Hanoi was capable of preparing and folding cargo parachutes, with the result that the chutes arrived in Haiphong by air or sea had to be transported to Hanoi for folding and then shipped back to Haiphong to be attached to cargo loads. A French mission from Indochina went to visit supply operations at the 8,081st Quartermaster Airborne Supply and Packaging Company of the U.S. Army at Ashiya Air Force Base and had returned amazed not so much at the efficiency of the American supply operation, which, at Ashiya, represented nothing out of the ordinary, but at the marvelous layout of the entire base. Less national pride and more willingness to learn from an ally would have helped the French a great deal. However, their unwillingness to devote extensive attention to quartermaster problems dated back more than a decade. It was also surprising to see that it took until April 14th for Dien Bien Phu to request the bulletproof vests that had first made their appearance in great numbers during the Korean War. Distributed to the artillerymen and other personnel fighting in fixed positions, they could well have saved Dien Bien Phu hundreds, if not thousands, of casualties. The initial request was processed by the United States forces in Japan within 5 days. It took the French supply system another 8 days to parachute the first load into Dien Bien Phu, and this fell straight into communist hands. A second load of 200 bulletproof vests finally arrived at Dien Bien Phu on April 27th, while another 100 was parachuted the same day on Isabelle. This shipment could have saved half the fortress's artillery crews had it been requested a month earlier. That day also, patrols of the 113th pushed as far west as Bonbon and Bonpapé. And on battered Huguette 6, three of the platoon commanders, Lieutenants Rastoy, François, and Merrick, had been down on their haunches with Captain Bizard for a brief talk on the situation while they ate meager combat rations when a heavy shell smashed right into the dugout, killing Rastoy and seriously wounding Merrick. Bizard and François were barely scratched. H6th had become a veritable hell. With its dugouts almost completely smashed, the garrison was constantly exposed either to the monsoon rains or to the blazing sun beating down on the flat plain. Thirst now had become a major problem. Bizard had begun to dig a well in the middle of the position, but thus far nothing but dirty, oily mud had come to the surface. Thursday, April 15th, 1954. There were three ways of reaching Huguette 6 from the main center of resistance at Dien Bien Phu. One was straight up along the open expanse of the airfield, over 1,500 meters of billiard-like plain mercilessly beaten by enemy artillery, clearly a suicidal operation. The second approach was west of the airfield along what remained of the Pavie track, which entailed running the enemy gauntlet of its now solidly held trench system around H1. Third, there existed an approach halfway between the two others, which consisted of following the airfield drainage ditch out of Strongpoint Sparrowhawk to a point north of the H1 bottleneck, but on the other side of the airfield, at which point it was necessary to race across the width of the airfield and reach the relative safety of the communication trenches leading northward from H1 to H6. All trails to H6 were rough. The needs of Captain Bizard's small band were simple: water and ammunition. Food in the form of individual combat rations and emergency rations was available, but the broiling heat brought on dehydration that could kill a man in 24 hours, and which still gave trouble to U.S. Marines at Da Nang in 1966. Every man had to drink at least a half gallon of liquid a day. For the approximately 200 men of the garrison, this meant 100 gallons a day, or 20 standard 5-gallon jerry cans that had to be carted for over 3 kilometers under fire. That was the job of the poor, miserable PIMs, the communist PWs, of whom there had been, on March 13th, 2,440 inside Dien Bien Phu. PIM stood for Prisonnier Interné Militaire, a term coined by the French Army to designate Viet Minh captives who had normal prisoner of war status, in contrast to communist civilian prisoners who were turned over to the Vietnamese authorities and who usually suffered a barbarous fate, not unlike that which they still suffer in 1967 in full violation of the appropriate articles of the Geneva Convention on War Victims of August 12, 1949. The PIMs were treated more or less according to the regulations, and their camps were subject to inspection by Monsieur Durin, the one-armed Swiss representative of the International Red Cross, or even by representatives of the other side, such as General Giap's own brother, who resided in the French-held zone. But this being a civil war, adherence to the Geneva Conventions was more often honored in the breach, with the results that the PIMs actually fell into three informal categories: the regular PIMs, duly registered in a camp, the PIMs informally detained by the unit which captured them and used by it as coolie labor, and the converted PIMs, who had volunteered to join the French Union forces as regular soldiers. In the latter case, a small scenario was usually adhered to, in the course of which the PIM was first reported as having escaped, and then the enlistment of a new Vietnamese soldier would be reported under a name different from that of the escapee. The 31st Engineers used PIMs for basic construction work. While it could be argued that the building of bridges and roads and cantonments was not, as such, military activity prohibited under the Geneva Convention, there is no doubt that the building of battery positions and of underground dugouts was a violation, as was the use of PIMs during the battle for the collection of airdropped supplies and carrying water and ammunition under the fire of their own brothers in arms. The PIM camp was located between Juneau and Claudine, and the PIMs were distributed every day at 07:30 and at 11:30 to the various units as requested. The word distributed was to have unfortunate consequences when a Viet Minh political commissar, Khang, discovered the distribution's hours still posted at the camp gate after the battle. Distribution, can you imagine? Said the commissar. You mean you are distributing people like issue items, like beans or biscuits? The prison camp at Dien Bien Phu was under the control of a kind young French officer, Lieutenant Patricot, who headed a guard detachment of 8 North Africans led by a Tunisian sergeant. Initially, the PIMs were supposed to have been flown out before the battle began, but this became impossible. It was also impossible to release them, and thus provide the enemy with another regiment of well-fed troops with the immense advantage of being thoroughly familiar with the fortress. Hence, they shared the fate of the French to the last day of the battle. Since they were not allocated any construction materials for their camp, the PIMs soon devised, with typical Vietnamese ingenuity, a new type of dugout which was soon adopted by the combat troops. It consisted of a deep vertical shaft at the bottom of which the PIMs dug a narrow tunnel just sufficiently wide for one prone body. If one was not prone to claustrophobia, this kind of individual dugout was as good as any built at Dien Bien Phu. The faithfulness of the PIMs at Dien Bien Phu to their captors remains a mystery to this day. Only 30 actually made a deliberate and successful attempt to escape while between the lines collecting dropped supplies. Patricot distinctly recalls the following conversation between a PIM and a Moroccan guard who had panicked under the artillery fire and was running away from his guard detail. The PIM ran after the Moroccan and brought him back to where the PIMs were sweating out the barrage and said to him, "You Moroccan here to guard PIM, you stay here." In the course of their supply collecting assignments, the PIMs often came upon freshly parachuted weapons or found fully loaded weapons on the battlefield. There was no known case of the PIMs trying to hide such weapons. It was not uncommon for PIMs to be separated from their guard while they were between the lines and minefields on the lookout for dropped cargo. More than once, one of the outposts suddenly radioed that he was being approached by some Viet Minh carrying our supplies. Under such living and working conditions, the losses suffered by the PIM force amounted to more than 50%. When the PIM infirmary was finally crushed one day by one of those one-ton cargoes whose parachute failed to open, killing 12 patients, the other PIMs and all other incoming prisoners were treated at Major Gawain's ACM-29 and in the proper order of the urgency of their wounds. After the fall of Dien Bien Phu, the Viet Minh made a special point of verifying that its own wounded prisoners had received proper medical attention. To everyone's relief, the enemy high command found no cause for complaint. But the supreme test of the feelings of the PIM for their captors also came at the end of the battle. The Viet Minh had vowed that they would try as war criminals French officers who had worked with the Thai guerrillas, the GCMA, intelligence, and any who had been part of the PIM guard detachment. Hundreds of the PIM knew Lieutenant Patricot by sight, and quite a few knew him by name. Not one denounced him. Major Koldebeuf, whose name, Beefneck, exactly translated his build and stature, also commanded a large PIM detachment as deputy to Major Clemenceau. As he, in turn, his hands tied tightly behind his back with telephone wire, marched off to prison camp after the battle, he passed by chance in front of his own PIM detachment awaiting transportation by the wayside. One by one, the PIM rose and gave him the military salute. One of them, who spoke French, said, "Bonne chance, mon commandant." They were booted away by their own liberators. Little is known as to how the Viet Minh treated its own returning prisoners. Perhaps they were treated, like those of the Soviet Union in 1945, as cowards and deserters. But in mid-April 1954, there still remained for the PIMs the final agony of the battle and the arduous task of supplying faraway Huguette 6. During the night of April 14th to 15th, the better part of the 1st and 2nd BEP attempted the passage via the Pavi track with a supply carrier detachment of about 50 PIMs. They were pinned down for almost 4 hours between H1 and H2, separated by only 200 meters of open terrain, fired on not only by the enemy artillery, but also by enemy infantry, still holding the trench blasted into the airfield. In addition, there was now an enemy machine gun nest in the carcass of the destroyed Curtiss C-46 commando aircraft. In the dishpan flat plain, that relative elevation of about 6 feet was enough to give the machine gun a commanding field of fire. It was to cost the French dearly later. Finally, at 0240, the supply convoy got through to Bizarre. The operation had cost the French a heavy price in casualties, and a good part of the supplies had been lost en route. Now the covering force had to face the grim prospect of the return trip in the face of an enemy who was fully aware of its presence. Longley thereupon decided to confuse the Viet Minh by launching two diversionary attacks. The first was led by Lieutenant Bali's company of the 8th Assault across from Sparrowhawk against the Viet Minh trench on the airfield. The second was led by Captain Philippe's composite Foreign Legion Company against something new in the Viet Minh siege arsenal, a regular enemy strongpoint. Indeed, the Viet Minh had, within the space of a single night, connected the trench system it had built during the previous days with a series of combat bunkers and firing positions, in front of which there even was some barbed wire and some of the mines collected from other French strongpoints. Undeterred, Philippe and his company of the 13th Half Brigade pressed forward, only to be pinned down by the enemy's automatic weapons and mortars. The company began to take heavy losses. Clemenceau was finally compelled to commit his last reserve unit, 2nd Company, to the fight. It finally extracted the remnants of Philippe's company from the trap, but also lost 10 men in the process. At the airfield trench, Bailly kept trying all day long to clear it in bloody hand-to-hand fighting, but was taking losses as every one of his men had first to race the gauntlet of the open field before reaching the communist trench. Finally, at 16:15, with the other two attacks a failure, and with the supply convoy at last back inside the French lines, the elements of the 8th withdrew back to the drainage ditch east of the airstrip. One half of the airfield and one-fifth of the total remaining area of Dien Bien Phu, along with some 400 of its best combat troops, now were in deep jeopardy. On April 15th, the supply runs to Dien Bien Phu reached their all-time high. In a steady drone of American-piloted C-119s and civilian and military C-47s and 46s flown by French Air Force and civilian crews, nearly 250 tons were dropped into the valley, almost as much as the daily maximum reached by the German Air Force at Stalingrad. Even though at least 15%, and according to Puget, almost one-half, fell into communist lines, it permitted the hard-pressed fortress to replenish its reserves at the following levels. 2 days of food, 5 days of 105mm shells, and 6 days of 120mm mortar shells. With the airdrops now being so large and so vital to the survival of the fortress, the communists made it a habit to register machine guns on some of the most conspicuous parcels and to await the dark of night in silence until some movement on the French side showed that an attempt was being made to collect them. Then the enemy machine guns would open up on the collection crews, often made up of the hapless PIMs, with devastating results. At 1700, a fighter bomber from the aircraft Arromanche was to drop a brand new complete set of aerial photographs of the valley, including all the French positions, and a set of maps especially drawn in Hanoi on extra-large 1 to 25,000 scale, showing all the new French positions, as well as all the detected enemy anti-aircraft positions. In addition, it carried a smaller scale, 1 to 100,000 map, of all of North Vietnam, with all the French code names of enemy targets and detailed notations of enemy transportation bottlenecks. As the plane approached the center of Dien Bien Phu for the free drop of the pouch, the pilot pushed back his heavy glass canopy, but at that moment enemy flak began to open up on him. At the last moment, the pilot attempted evasive tactics and went into a wing-over-wing barrel roll. The heavy pouch, marked clearly for easier identification, fell right out of the cockpit and into enemy hands. Now General Giap not only knew almost as much about Dien Bien Phu as de Castries did, but he also knew exactly what the French knew, or did not know, about his armed forces. This meant that French codes had to be changed throughout Indochina, and perhaps dozens of infiltrated French agents paid with their lives for the nervousness of one pilot. To make matters worse, more packages of photos were lost from another airplane on the following day. On Isabelle, the much-battered Thai subgroupment Wiem, which had held its improvised strongpoint against heavy enemy pressure since the beginning of the battle without breaking or deserting, was finally relieved by Captain Desiree's 9th TIE Company, the one outfit of 3rd BT that had not disintegrated. The enemy detected the suspicious movement on Weem and hit the position at the dangerous moment when one unit was not yet installed and the other unit had not yet withdrawn. There were losses among both the new arrivals and the departing tribesmen. Friday, April 16th, 1954. Good Friday began with yet another costly breakthrough operation to H-6. Again, almost 60 PIMs were escorted by elements from both the 2 BEPs and from the 6th BPC. By now, the operation had become a death march, in which the PIMs, with their clanking jerry cans or ammunition boxes, simply did not have a chance. They had set out with 700 liters of water and a half dozen boxes of small arms ammunition. According to the official report of the day, 42 PIMs were killed or wounded in the breakthrough, and only 7 water carriers, with 5 jerry cans of water, made it safely to H-6. This left every man of the garrison with about 1 pint at the most, instead of the 2 quarts needed. It was clear that the French could not afford to supply H-6 indefinitely. Around H-1 also, the situation had seriously deteriorated. At 10:20, Dien Bien Phu reported that communist trenches around H-1 now reached the airfield, and that the strong point was thus completely surrounded. On H-2, where 2 companies from Claudine's 113 Half Brigade under Lieutenants Viard and Chenet had relieved the exhausted troops of the 12 REI, the decision was made to make an attempt at beating the Viet Minh at their own game. Instead of attempting to force their way into H-1 through costly assaults, the Legionnaires would now try to patiently dig their way forward toward H-1. The problem, of course, was that at one point the north-south trench of the Legionnaires would encounter the communist west-east trench south of Huguette 1. Being Legionnaires, they would cross that bridge when they reached it. But among the logisticians at Dien Bien Phu, the old and never-resolved struggle between supply and personnel requirements continued. To be sure, that mid-April period was to witness some of the best days of air transport, what with the relatively good flying weather permitting effective fighter and fighter-bomber protection for the defenseless supply carriers. April 16th was another day where the supplies loaded at Haiphong and Hanoi reached 215 tons, with a misdropped percentage of 10% and an effective collection ratio of perhaps 2-1, but de Castries complained in bitter terms that he now needed mechanics and electricians to keep the last remaining vehicles and, above all, the precious electric generators and water purifiers going. And finally, the artillery gun crews were reaching, after 32 days of constant duty in the open gun pits, a state of total physical and psychological breakdown. The accuracy and speed of the counter-battery fire now began to suffer. The men still went through the motions, but it was no longer possible to get from them the reaction, speed, and accuracy necessary to utilize the few guns and the now closely rationed artillery shells with maximum effectiveness. De Castries once more requested that the remainder of the 35th Airborne Artillery be dropped into the valley. Of the 49 officers and men of the 35th RALP who had been parachuted in during the month, only 27 would be fit for duty on April 24th, and the remaining airborne gun crews outside the valley were sorely needed in other areas as well. Hanoi had no encouraging answers to any of those questions. All it had to offer that day was the news that Colonel de Castries had been promoted to Brigadier General and that most of the other senior commanders in the fortress had been advanced 1 notch on the promotion list. Longley and Lalande were now full colonels, Bijard became a lieutenant colonel, and the many captains, who in fact had commanded battalions for months, were now promoted to majors. In a comradely gesture, the higher-ranking officers passed on their old rank insignia to the newly promoted lower-ranking officers. Thus, Colonel Longley inherited Colonel de Castries' 5 stripes, but since the latter, as a cavalryman, wore them on a red background, Longley had to use India ink to dye it black. Major General Cogny, in Hanoi, who had still been a brigadier general the year before, had his own brigadier stars parachuted to de Castries, along with a bottle of champagne. They fell outside the French lines into communist hands. Saturday, April 17th, 1954. As night fell on the 16th, another column of paratroopers from the 6th BPC and the 2 BEPs escorted yet another convoy of water carriers to the hell of H-6. In almost routine fashion, the supply group met a communist roadblock near the communist trenches south of Ouguette 1, ran the gauntlet of the machine gun nest installed in the wreck of the Curtis Commando, and, after a small firefight, finally reached H6 at 0125 with only minor losses. This time, the convoy had succeeded in bringing in enough water not only for the garrison's minimal water ration, but also for it to drink to de Castries' general stars and to the officer's cross of the Legion of Honor, which 29-year-old Captain Bizard just had received for his gallant defense of H6. But even this small success begged the question as to whether holding H6 was worth the price. Longley had calculated the cost of maintaining open communications with H6 during the preceding week, and it amounted to more dead and wounded than the whole counteroffensive for the conquest of Elion 1. Against this, two factors could be thrown into the equation. First was the fact that during the past night, a total of only 80 reinforcements had been parachuted in. Second, the northern part of the airfield was, in view of the communist trenches which now pierced it, useless as a drop zone anyway. General de Castries accepted Longley's reading of the situation, and at 18:20 decided to evacuate Ouguette 6 during the following night. At the same time, he requested a maximum air effort from Hanoi in support of the evacuation operation. It is difficult to judge if the amputation of H6, as of April 18th, was a serious flaw in reasoning. The decision was apparently made by two ground force officers without consulting the air operations officer, Major Guérin. The loss of H6 was almost immediately followed by a closing in of the enemy anti-aircraft artillery and machine guns onto the runway. This made the flying of a set course by the transport aircraft even more hazardous than before, and thus materially affected the ability of Dien Bien Phu to survive. Aside from the elements of the 2-1 RCP, which again faced a determined communist probe on E-1 and counterattacked later in the day, Bijard committed at 20-100 the bulk of the 1st BEP and elements of the 8th Assault and detachments from the 1-2 REI, along with two tanks, to the breakthrough to H-6. At 2200, Bijard and his task force had reached the enemy trench blocking the airfield at the latitude of Ouguette 1. In fact, the word trench no longer was applicable here, because the communists had dug a veritable trench system composed of several separate lines facing both the encircled strongpoint and the main center of resistance, from which the counterattacks would come. At 2200, the task force had finally fought its way through two trench lines, but now was, in the words of Colonel Longley, out of breath, of ammunition, and of men. Easter Sunday, April 18th, 1954. 4 hours later, at 0200 of April 18th, after Bijard had thrown in every unit that could be scraped together, namely a weak company of his own 6th BPC and another one of Moroccan riflemen from the 1-4 RTM, the attack bogged down completely. The breakthrough force, caught in part on the open airfield and in part in the newly occupied communist trenches, began to take heavy losses. As dawn broke, the French pulled back toward a bunker system now being set up by the engineers in the airfield drainage ditch, called Opera, which provided a small measure of protection against enemy shells, in spite of the fact that flooding was a severe problem. Another part of the breakthrough force had withdrawn westward beyond H1, where the engineers were also installing a new small holding position at the crossroads north of H2. At 0730, even the tough Bijard, the man who probably believed longest that Dien Bien Phu had a fighting chance of surviving, was ready to concede that the attempt at rescuing H6 had failed, and that a new attempt might devour men and supplies far beyond any benefits that could be derived from rescuing even a few of the defenders of H6. Bijard left Major Clemenceau the unpleasant task of informing Bizard by radio that he would have to attempt his own breakout if possible, but that no one would blame him if, in view of the number of wounded, he had to abandon them, or, in view of the pitifully small chance at H6 he had of breaking through, he chose to surrender to the enemy. In order to be sure that the communists would not understand what had been said, the whole radio conversation between the two officers had taken place in English. But for young Bizard and his mixed bag of foreign legionnaires and French and Vietnamese paratroopers, there was no question of surrendering. He informed Clemenceau that a breakout would be attempted at 0800 sharp. The decision was made to break out on a broad front, using mainly hand grenades, while abandoning all wounded and all heavy equipment to the enemy. In order to protect themselves from the effects of their own grenade splinters, most of the men slung sandbags partially filled with earth over their chests and backs as they lined up, facing southward, in their own forward trench, only 30 meters away from the first communist line. They knew that the breakout would be difficult, but Bizard's men at least enjoyed the tactical advantage that the Viet Minh fully expected the breakthrough of rescue forces from the south, while it did not believe that the battered survivors of H-6 would, in their weakened state, attempt anything as desperate as a breakout. And since the communists themselves fully expected to use their trench for the final assault on H-6, there was no barbed wire or mines between them and the French garrison. Moreover, early morning fog, which, as usual, covered most of the valley, hid the movements of the French troops on H-6 from the enemy. Finally, on a shouted order of Bizard, the thin line